Chapter 7, Improving Aid, read by Peter Singer.
The Critics. Though we have already looked briefly at some common objections to aid, we haven't yet done justice to the serious critics who point out that many aid programs have failed to reduce poverty. Prominent among these critics is economist William Easterly, who in his 2007 book, The White Man's Burden, laments the ineffectiveness of aid. He writes, "The West spent $2.3 trillion on foreign aid over the last 5 decades and still had not managed to get 12-cent medicines to children to prevent half of all malaria deaths. The West spent $2.3 trillion and still had not managed to get $4 bed nets to poor families. It's a tragedy that so much well-meaning compassion did not bring these results for needy people." Did you get the impression from that quote that over the past 50 years, the West has shown great compassion and given enormous sums of foreign aid? We have already seen that most Western nations are giving very little aid as a proportion of their national income. But Easterly is talking about the 5 decades leading up to 2006. So before we get to the issue of aid's effectiveness, let's first do some Q&A on how much aid the West really gave during this period. Question. How much per year is $2.3 trillion over 5 decades? Answer, $46 billion. Question. How much per person living in affluent nations during that period is $46 billion? Answer. In 2006, there were roughly 1 billion people living in affluent nations, but the average over the preceding 50-year period was around 750 million people. That works out to about $60 per person per year. Question. What percentage of the total income of the affluent nations over that period is $46 billion? Answer. Aid over that period was about 0.3%, or about 30 cents of every $100 the nations earned. Now the amount of aid that the rich nations are giving doesn't seem so large, does it? Nor has there been any increase in the decade since Easterly's book was published in the proportion of national income that the rich nations have given in aid. To get some perspective on this, in 2017, worldwide, net official development assistance and aid was approximately $170 billion, while in the same year, consumers spent $532 billion on cosmetics. We say that we aspire to end extreme poverty in 11 years, yet we spend more than 3 times as much on beauty products as the governments we elect spend on ending extreme poverty. Even the figure of 30 cents given in aid from every $100 earned seriously exaggerates the amount that the rich nations gave during that 50-year period to help the world's poorest people. Much of the aid was based on political or defense priorities rather than humanitarian considerations. During the Cold War, for example, aid from the West was heavily tilted toward luring third world countries away from Soviet influence. The hundreds of millions of dollars that went into the Swiss bank accounts of the Congolese dictator Mobutu Sese Seko were part of the so-called aid that is included in Easterly's figure. No surprise that it did little to reduce poverty. Although the Cold War ended long ago, aid is still not allocated solely, or in some cases even primarily, to the places where it will do the most good for people in extreme poverty. In 2016-17, the most recent year for which, at the time of writing, data is available, Afghanistan topped the list of recipients of US aid, receiving $1.3 billion. That was $348 million more than Ethiopia, the next country on the list. Afghanistan has been the largest recipient of US aid for several years now, and before it gained that position, it was second to Iraq, which in 2007 received nearly 30% of the entire US aid budget. Afghanistan is undoubtedly a very poor country, but so is Ethiopia, and Ethiopia has 3 times as many people as Afghanistan. Perhaps if the US had invaded Ethiopia, it would have received as much aid as Afghanistan did. A second reason that total figures for aid can give an exaggerated impression of what is being done to help the poor is that some countries, including the United States and Australia, tie their aid to the purchase of goods that they make, thus boosting their own economies, but making the aid less effective. The United States ties more of its aid than any other major donor, an estimated 32%. For example, US government agencies donating condoms intended to stop the spread of AIDS in Africa must buy them from US manufacturers, although US-made condoms are twice the price of similar products made in Asia. Donating condoms to Africa saves lives, but since the amount of money available for this purpose is fixed, anything that increases the cost of the condoms reduces the number donated and translates into lives lost. Congress also requires that almost all US food aid must be grown domestically, even though it would be far cheaper to buy the grain in the region where it is needed, saving on shipping costs and other overheads, as well as avoiding a delay of about 4 months in delivery of the food. A study of the 2008 Farm Bill found that local sourcing of food would result in a significant cost saving, 25% on pulses and legumes and 53% on grains. Worse still, when low-income countries import large quantities of subsidized food, the price that their own farmers can get for their crops falls, and this reduces the incentive for them to produce more. In addition, the cargo preference mandate demands that at least 50% of food aid is to be shipped on US-flagged vessels, although freight rates on those vessels are up to 40% higher than internationally competitive rates. The US Government Accountability Office, the nonpartisan investigative arm of Congress, has concluded that food aid is, quote, inherently inefficient. While Daniel Maxwell and Christopher Barrett, in their major study, Food Aid After 50 Years, dispel what they refer to as the myth that American food aid is primarily about feeding the hungry. These disadvantages have become sufficiently clear for CARE, one of the largest US agencies working against poverty, to refuse to distribute American grain in poor countries, even though it would have received $45 million if it had been prepared to do so. The American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank, estimates that if both the food sourcing and cargo preference mandates were reformed, the cost of aid delivery would be reduced by $300 million a year. This would allow millions more to access life-saving and life-changing aid. The problem, however, is political. The disproportionate political influence of rural states in the US means that grain producers have been able to distort the US aid program to such an extent that it is as much a program to aid US farmers as it is to aid hungry people in low-income countries. You may think that it's entirely reasonable for countries to make their aid conditional in this way, but if you're willing to argue that, then it isn't fair to conclude that all aid is ineffective. Part of the aim of tied aid is to benefit the donor country's own economy, and presumably it sometimes does achieve this. If we take into account the factors mentioned above, we find that during the 5 decades to which Easterly was referring when he claimed that $2.3 trillion in aid had not ended poverty, what was actually spent on aid, intended primarily to benefit people living in extreme poverty, was nothing like $60 per year for each citizen of the wealthy nations. It may have been less than a quarter of that amount. Suppose, though, that the full $60 had gone to aid for the poorest. That's still less than you may spend, with that much thought at all, on dinner for two at a modestly priced restaurant, and much less than you would spend if you go to an expensive restaurant or a concert. Does the cost of one night out really amount to what Easterly calls so much well-meaning compassion? That suggests low expectations of the compassion of our fellow human beings. It also means that we cannot sweepingly condemn aid as ineffective by claiming that our immense compassion has already led us to pour vast sums of aid into poor nations, but that these vast sums have failed to do even basic things like prevent malaria deaths. If we haven't yet succeeded in doing these basic things, maybe it is because we have given too little funding specifically for those purposes. Most aid critics target government-run programs and government-funded institutions. Easterly's book, The White Man's Burden, for example, focuses mainly on the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the United Nations, and the United States Agency for International Development, known as USAID. Easterly argues that these organizations' failures result from grandiose ambitions, top-down planning, and a lack of accountability. but he almost entirely ignores the work of non-governmental organizations. They are mentioned only 4 times in a book of 400 pages, and in none of these references is there a sustained discussion of the organization's work. Major individual aid organizations, for example, CARE, Oxfam, Save the Children, and World Vision, do not appear at all. Thus, while Eastley advises activists to, quote, change your issue from raising more aid money to making sure that the aid money reaches the poor, he supplies no basis for his suggestion that raising more aid money is futile if the activist addressed is raising money for a non-governmental organization. And I have yet to be approached by a fundraiser asking me to donate to the World Bank. More recently, Eastley has acknowledged that he has no objection to the activities of some of the non-profit organizations recommended in this book and by The Life You Can Save. In response to a question asked after his 2015 Hayek Memorial Lecture in London, in which he emphasized respect for the rights of the poor, he said, "Of course, giving mosquito nets to a poor person does not violate their rights. If they say they want the mosquito net, you give them the mosquito net. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever." Gambisa Moyo, a Harvard-educated economist from Zambia, created a stir with her book, Dead Aid, in which she argued that cutting off aid to African governments would force them to raise money from taxation, and that this would make them more transparent and more accountable to their citizens. It is very difficult to know whether this is correct, and whether the benefits of increased transparency and accountability would outweigh the benefits that would be lost if aid were cut off. What is clear, however, is that Moyo is not referring to aid from non-governmental agencies, because she says this explicitly in her book. Angus Deaton, a Nobel Prize-winning economist and the author of The Great Escape, about how most of the world's population escaped extreme poverty, expresses concern that aid allows governments to avoid their responsibilities to their citizens. He nevertheless accepts the fact that aid has been important in fighting malaria, HIV/AIDS, and some neglected tropical diseases. The most impressive example of what aid can do is the eradication of smallpox. For at least 3,000 years, smallpox was a fearsome scourge of humankind. Of those infected by it, almost 1 in 3 died a painful, miserable death. The survivors also experienced pain and distress. Many were left blind and/or permanently disfigured. As recently as 1967, smallpox caused 2 million deaths, distributed across 43 countries. 10 years later, it had been completely eradicated, except for one subsequent death as a result of poor safety procedures at the University of Birmingham Medical School in England, where the virus was being studied. The eradication was the result of a concerted global vaccination campaign first proposed in 1958 by the Soviet Union's Deputy Minister for Health, a virologist named Viktor Zhdanov, and then taken up by the World Health Organization. In the first 60 years of the 20th century, smallpox killed between 1.5 and 3 million people every year. If we conservatively use the low end of this range, its eradication, 42 years ago at the time of writing, has saved the lives of 63 million people and prevented another 147 million from suffering from a painful and debilitating disease. This is, as William McCaskill points out in his book Doing Good Better, about 5 times the number of people killed in all the wars, atrocities, and terrorist attacks that have taken place since the 1970s, including the killing fields of Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge, the 1994 massacres of Tutsis in Rwanda, the wars in the Congo, Afghanistan, and Iraq, and the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. We can add the wars in Syria and Yemen, and terrorism right up to the 2019 terrorist attack on Muslims in Christchurch, and we still won't get to more than a quarter of the number saved by the eradication of smallpox. That is why McCaskill has suggested that Viktor Zhdanov may have done more good for humanity than any other person who has ever lived. McCaskill wasn't adding these numbers up for fun. He is one of the founders of the effective altruism movement and was responding to criticisms of aid, including Eastley's claim that the $2.3 trillion spent over the 5 decades leading up to 2006 was not money well spent. To the contrary, he argues, let's suppose that those $2.3 trillion did nothing except eradicate smallpox. Then aid would have saved more than 60 million lives at a cost per life saved of about $40,000. As we saw in the previous chapter, that's not as cheap as some of the life-saving interventions we can support today, like providing bed nets or broadcasting health information in low-income countries by radio advertisements. Still, when we compare it with the figure of 9.6 million used by the US Department of Transport as a guide to how much should be spent on road safety improvements that will save one life, it's a real bargain. Even if one believes that governments rightly put a higher priority on saving the lives of their own citizens than they do on saving the lives of the citizens of other countries, it would be difficult to defend a discount rate that values the life of a citizen from a country where smallpox was prevalent during the 1950s as worth only 1/200th of the life of a citizen of an affluent country. Remember too that the calculations of the previous paragraph are based on the assumption that the $2.3 trillion donated in aid achieved nothing except eradicating smallpox. In fact, there's good evidence that the aid did many other positive things as well. No one really knows whether poverty on a global scale could be overcome by a truly substantial amount of aid provided without political interference. It's never been tried. The political and bureaucratic constraints that encumber official aid make private donations to effective, non-governmental agencies all the more important. The worst that can be said about aid with any certainty is that in the past, a lot of official aid has been misconceived and misdirected and has done little good. But the data we are now accumulating from much field research and many randomized controlled trials makes it very plausible that if we truly set out to reduce poverty and put resources that match the size of the problem into doing so, including resources to evaluate past failures and learn from our mistakes, we will be able to sharply reduce extreme poverty. Aid and economic growth. Some aid critics claim that only a growing economy can lift the poor out of poverty. Aid, they say, even if it may help to prevent people from dying of malaria, measles, and other diseases, does not spur economic growth. Martin Wolf, for example, in Why Globalization Works, argues that reducing the barriers that poor nations face when they seek to sell their products on the global market would do more to reduce poverty than any amount of aid. As evidence, Wolf and other aid critics claim that the nations that have pulled themselves out of poverty during the past 50 years have generally received little aid, whereas the nations that have received the most aid are generally still poor. This, however, is not a fair test of the effect of aid on growth, because those countries facing greater problems, for whatever reason, are likely to receive more aid. Nor, of course, can we do randomized controlled trials with different poor countries, giving aid to some, but not to others, to see what difference the aid makes. But a group of economists from the University of Maryland, Michigan State University, and the World Bank noticed that since 1987, whether a country is eligible for aid from the International Development Association has been based partly on whether the country's per capita income is below a specific threshold. When countries cross that threshold, they cease to get aid from the International Development Association. Moreover, the economists found, the loss of aid from that particular source is not made up for by increased donations from other sources. On the contrary, other donors appear to follow the lead of the International Development Association and reduce their aid to the countries that cross the threshold to such an extent that overall aid, expressed as a proportion of gross national income, drops by an average of 59%. So the economists decided to investigate what happened to economic growth in the 35 countries that moved over the threshold between 1987 and 2010. Their findings, I quote, "a positive, statistically significant, and economically sizable effect of aid on growth." But to be more precise, if the ratio of aid to gross national income increased by just 1% above the average for the sample countries, annual real per capita growth increased by approximately 0.35%. Aid, it seems, far from slowing economic growth, increases it. Notwithstanding that good news, it's clear that some aid initiatives have failed to promote economic growth. One reason that aid could slow economic growth is Dutch disease, a term the Economist coined to describe a decline in the Dutch economy in the 1960s after natural gas was discovered in the North Sea, off the country's coast. This valuable natural resource should have been a great economic boon, but in fact, as the revenues from gas exports began flowing in, Dutch manufacturing slumped. The reason, according to economists, was that as other countries bought Dutch oil, sending money into the country, the value of the Dutch currency rose relative to that of the country's main trading partners, thus making Dutch exports more expensive and Dutch manufacturers less competitive in international markets. The inflow of a large amount of foreign aid can cause a similar problem. Although, as we've seen, aid is a tiny percentage of the income of affluent donor nations, the poor nations are so poor that in some cases aid amounts to more than 10% of their national income. In a handful of very poor countries, such as the Central African Republic, Somalia, and Malawi, aid amounts to approximately a quarter of the national income, and it is close to 20% for Liberia and Afghanistan. At that level, aid can cause a very substantial Dutch disease effect. But much depends on the use made of the aid. When aid improves infrastructure, agricultural methods, and the skill levels of the workforce, it enhances productivity and leads to increased exports that can outweigh the Dutch disease problem. For 10 years after the end of Mozambique's civil war in 1992, European nations gave an extraordinarily high level of aid to that African country. In fact, over those years, 40% of the nation's gross income was foreign aid. Although almost half of the aid was debt relief, which therefore could not be spent within Mozambique, aid was also used to build roads, hospitals, and schools, and to improve workforce skills. Perhaps for this reason, real economic growth per capita was also impressive, averaging 5.5% per annum. High levels of aid to Botswana after independence in 1966, to Taiwan in the 1950s, and to Uganda in the 1990s also proved compatible with strong economic growth. These examples prove that Dutch disease is by no means inevitable. In any case, when it comes to barriers to the growth of export industries in developing countries, there is something more significant than aid-related Dutch disease. US and European agricultural subsidies undercut poor countries' efforts to increase their exports in an economic sector where their climate and cheap labour give them a natural competitive advantage. Take, as an example, cotton. Four of the world's poorest countries, Burkina Faso, Mali, Benin, and Chad, all in West Africa, rely on cotton as the only source of income for millions of their peasant farmers. Many of these farmers are supporting families on less than $2 a day. They produce cotton more cheaply and in a more ecologically sustainable way than the 1,195 highly mechanized cotton growers in the United States, who between them shared $663 million in taxpayer-funded subsidies in 2017. That's an average of more than $500,000 each, and that's just the subsidy, not what they earn from selling the cotton. In some years, the value of the subsidies has exceeded the market value of the cotton that the subsidized growers are producing. In contrast, Moussa Doumbia, a cotton farmer in Mali who was interviewed by Elizabeth Day for The Guardian, earned less than $300 a year for his backbreaking labour growing and then harvesting the cotton on his small plot of land. He struggled to feed his children or to buy medicine for them when they fell ill. Not surprisingly, he had no idea that he was getting less for his cotton because American taxpayers are giving huge subsidies to American cotton growers. Daniel Sumner, who directs the University of California Agricultural Issues Center, has calculated that if the United States were to end its cotton subsidy, the resulting rise in the income of a West African cotton grower would be enough to cover all healthcare costs for four children. The elimination of all agricultural subsidies and a 50% reduction in non-agricultural tariffs would, according to a study by economists Kim Anderson and Alan Winters, mean a global economic gain of at least $96 billion annually, of which $30 billion would go to the developing world. It would also save US taxpayers more than $16 billion per year, and European taxpayers even more. You might now ask whether it would be better to spend our time and money campaigning to eliminate trade barriers rather than donating it to agencies that give aid to the poor. Obviously, this depends on a variety of factors: whether our money and time would make the success of such a campaign more likely, how great the gain for the poor would be if such a campaign succeeded, and how much good our donations could do if given for other forms of aid. The powerful political interests allied against the elimination of trade barriers make political change unlikely. In the US, agricultural subsidies are authorized by farm bills, which are renewed every 6 years. At those times, the subsidies often face staunch opposition. In 2008, opposition to the subsidies united conservatives seeking to cut government expenditure and liberals who don't like handouts to people who are already wealthy. The conservatives had strong support from President George W. Bush, who described the bill as bloated and wasteful. And when it passed nevertheless, he vetoed it. Yet Congress managed to muster the two-thirds majority needed to override the veto. Even when Congress stripped a subsidy from the 2014 Farm Bill, two new subsidies quickly took its place when Congress passed the Price Loss Coverage and Agricultural Risk Coverage bills. These subsidies favor wealthier U.S. farms, including wealthy cotton growers. President Donald Trump has proposed subsidy cuts, but as the historical record shows, Congress is quite likely to ignore the president's suggestion. That doesn't mean that it is not worth trying to eliminate the subsidies next time the farm bill is up for renewal. It merely indicates that the odds are against success. Less grotesquely unfair trade rules would help, but still would not guarantee that trade would lift every region out of poverty. Economic growth can bypass people, regions, and even entire countries. That may be because a country's government is following ill-advised economic policies, or because politics, customs, and social structures are so inimical to economic productivity that few are willing to invest, in which case economic aid can be made conditional on policy reform. But it may also be because the country suffers from geographical disadvantages, being landlocked, say, and surrounded by poor neighbours that do not offer promising markets. Then growth may be blocked by the difficulty of reaching more prosperous markets for exports. In those situations, aid aimed at improving local food production and providing education and basic health care may be the best, indeed the only, way of helping the country's poor. Ideally, aid should provide a safety net for those who, for whatever reason, are not benefiting from economic growth. Economic growth is not the only way for a country to improve the lives of its citizens. Sometimes poorer countries do better on key indicators of human well-being, such as infant mortality and longevity, than richer ones. Cuba, famously, has lower infant mortality than the United States. When William Easterly and Bill Gates were on a panel together at the World Economic Forum in 2007, Easterly made his usual point that all the aid given to Africa over the years has failed to stimulate economic growth there. Gates responded sharply, "I don't promise that when a kid lives, it will cause a gross national product increase. I think life has value." Gates is right. Our focus should not be on growth for its own sake, but the goals that lie behind our desire for growth: saving lives, reducing misery, and meeting people's basic needs. Bad institutions undo good projects. In the long-running debate about why some nations are rich and others are poor, many experts emphasize the importance of good institutions and practices, like the rule of law, protection of property rights, effective government, social conventions that make trust possible, good and universal schooling, and low tolerance of corruption. Effective government means that the public sector works tolerably well. If we want to start a business, we won't have to bribe officials to get things done, and our rights as workers, consumers, and residents will be protected from unsafe workplaces, unsafe products, and industrial pollution. The rule of law protects us from violence and allows us to plan for the future with reasonable confidence that what we own will not be taken from us. It enables us to make contracts, knowing that the other contracting parties will be penalized if they breach them. Since there are always costs in resorting to the law, however, a certain level of trust makes it easier for people to work together and creates a sense of community. The idea that good institutions play a crucial role in reducing poverty leads not to denying the value of aid, but rather to making aid conditional on the recipient government doing its part in providing the conditions for economic growth. This way of thinking persuaded President George W. Bush in 2002 to set up, with bipartisan support, the Millennium Challenger Grant, an initiative reserving a portion of US aid for governments that, in the president's words, govern justly, invest in their people, and encourage economic freedom. To administer the account, the legislation also set up an independent agency called the Millennium Challenge Corporation. The Millennium Challenge Corporation continued throughout the Obama administration and is the only sector of the US aid program that has been receiving favorable attention from the Trump administration. Although the Millennium Challenge Corporation has been criticized for using aid to spread the capitalist model of development, the conditions that countries have to meet to be eligible for aid have been credited with many successes, including improvements in Liberia's educational data, anti-corruption efforts in Sierra Leone, and more local achievements such as sales of land in the Senegal River Valley to women. A study by the Center for Global Development, a frequent critic of US government aid programs, found that in African countries that had entered into a compact with the Millennium Challenge Corporation, US aid programs had a dramatically higher alignment with the priorities of citizens, as measured by public surveys, than they did in countries that had not entered into a compact. Paul Collier, an economist who studies aid and its impact on development, has demonstrated that aid can be effective in improving institutions, particularly when dealing with fragile states. Countries emerging from civil war, for instance, are at high risk of falling back into conflict, with all the misery that that will bring to their citizens. Collier has shown that substantial amounts of aid, properly directed and sustained for several years, can enhance the capacity of governments to avoid that tragedy. Mozambique, which suffered through decades of internal war, is one example where aid has made a difference, and Sierra Leone is another. Opportunities arise, too, when a reforming government replaces a corrupt or incompetent regime with one that is more honest and capable, as in the case of Levi Mwanawasa's government in Zambia, which succeeded an extremely corrupt government when it took office in 2002. Collier found that in such cases, providing $1 billion worth of technical assistance over 4 years could be expected to produce $15 billion worth of economic benefits in the country, not counting the gain to the world that comes from countries having effective governments. If making our aid conditional on reform can help to improve corrupt or inefficient governments and to avoid conflict, there are circumstances in which that is the right thing to do. Tragically, sometimes conditions are so bad that nothing we can do will diminish the misery of a bad government's unfortunate citizens. Then we have to go elsewhere. But at other times, aid can directly help the poorest, making a significant and sustainable difference to them, even if that does not lead to better institutions. In that case, we should not withhold it. Evaluating what works. 1. Microfinance. The story of microfinance goes back to 1976, when Muhammad Yunus was head of the Department of Economics at Chittagong University in Bangladesh. His research on rural poverty took him to the nearby village of Jobra, where he found that women making furniture had to borrow from local moneylenders to buy the bamboo they needed. The moneylenders charged such high rates of interest that the women could never work their way out of poverty. Yunus took the equivalent of $27 from his own pocket and lent it to a group of 42 women from the village. Incredibly, this tiny sum, about 64 cents per person, was enough to put them on the path to independence from the moneylenders and eventually to repaying the loan and working their way out of poverty. Encouraged by this success, Yunus persuaded a government bank to lend money for a pilot project that would make very small loans to villagers. Over the next 6 years, the pilot project made thousands of loans, usually to groups of women. The women knew that if they did not repay the loans, others in the group would not be able to borrow, so virtually all the loans were repaid. This reversed the then accepted economic wisdom that lending to the poor carries high risks and therefore can be economically viable only if high rates of interest are charged. In 1982, Yunus founded the Grameen Bank, or Village Bank, to provide loans across Bangladesh. It grew to extend loans to several million customers in that country, many of whom had no credit rating, assets, or employment history. And yet 97% of the loans it made were repaid in full. As a result, the Grameen Bank became a model for thousands of institutions all over the world that began to offer microcredit, small loans to poor people. Microcredit seemed to be so successful at helping people escape poverty that in 2006, the Nobel Peace Prize was given to Yunus. In making the award, the committee recognized the danger of excessive expectations and warned that overcoming poverty cannot be realized by means of microcredit alone. But it then went on to say that microcredit must play a major part in ending poverty. GiveWell was sufficiently positive about microcredit to give one of its early grants to a microfinance organization, Opportunity International. Over the next 10 years, however, the hope that microcredit would play a major role in overcoming poverty dwindled. Researchers from Innovations for Poverty Action and from the Jameel Poverty Action Lab, both leading centres for research into what does and does not work to reduce poverty, carried out six separate studies of microcredit. They concluded that small, short-term loans generally do not lead to increased income, investments in children's schooling, or substantial gains in women's empowerment for poor borrowers. That doesn't mean that microcredit does no good at all. Making loans available to poor people can help them deal with emergencies and feed their families in lean times. But microcredit doesn't transform the lives of borrowers, nor does it make a major contribution to ending poverty. 2. No lean season. Charities typically get started because, like Muhammad Yunus, the founders care about a problem, extreme poverty, for example, and have an idea about how to solve it. They may try that solution in one location and find that it helps, so they get enthused about implementing their plan and scaling it up in the hope that it will take care of the problem worldwide. To do that, they form a charity and gain support from donors who also care about the issue and believe in the strategy. This model may seem intuitively appealing, but it makes it difficult for the founders to be objective in assessing the success of their project. What is really needed is a commitment not to a particular solution, but to following the evidence. That is the approach taken by Evidence Action, one of the Life You Can Save's recommended nonprofits. It runs both large-scale programs and a beta incubator that tests promising interventions to assess impact, cost-effectiveness, and scalability before deciding whether to scale them up. No Lean Season, a program in the beta incubator, was designed to address a dramatic drop-off in work opportunities for ultra-poor rural labourers that often occurs during the period between planting crops and harvesting them. This lean season poverty affects 600 million people globally. The idea behind No Lean Season was that providing small travel subsidies or loans would enable labourers to get to a nearby city or another rural area with different labour opportunities. There they might find jobs during the lean season in which they would earn much more than they could if they stayed in the countryside. This wasn't just a plausible theory, it had been tested in small-scale, randomised controlled trials conducted in northern Bangladesh, showing positive impacts on income and consumption for participant families. These trials, and the estimated cost-effectiveness of the No Lean Season program, were so promising that GiveWell named No Lean Season a top charity for 2017. Evidence Action knows that scaling up programs isn't easy. Delivering services to a few villages, for example, requires different skills and resources from delivering those services at a regional or countrywide level. For this reason, Evidence Action doesn't rely on small-scale testing alone, even if it is properly randomized and produces statistically significant results. Evidence Action continues to test its programs as they increase in scale, and in the case of No Lean Season, collaborated with leading economists to conduct another randomized controlled trial to understand whether the program had the same positive outcomes when scaled up. Once the results of this large-scale trial were analysed, No Lean Season's intervention looked less promising. In particular, the researchers found that fewer workers took up the loans, which meant that the program had no impact on inducing migration or subsequently on income or consumption. But here's the most remarkable thing about this story. Evidence Action's leaders, researchers and field workers had invested time, money and a good deal of hope in No Lean Season. You might therefore expect that the organisation would play down the outcome of the large-scale trial, perhaps claiming that there were flaws in the study, or that they'd found a way to overcome the deficiencies the tests revealed. Instead, Evidence Action informed GiveWell that No Lean Season shouldn't be named a top charity for 2018 and stopped raising funds for the program, while conducting further research to determine whether some changes to the program would produce the positive outcomes found in the earlier local trial. As Evidence Action was waiting for results from the new trial, though, other issues arose, including evidence that proper financial procedures had not always been followed by their local partner organisation. After further investigation, Evidence Action concluded that they should end the No Lean Season program entirely. Evidence Action's transparency and honesty has made the organisation a model of how an evidence-based organisation should act in these difficult situations. As Evidence Action's Chief Executive Officer, Kanika Bal, puts it, organisations must be willing to make tough calls and exit programs when appropriate. Bal goes on to note that, I quote, "The takeaway is not that if a program faces challenges, an NGO should walk away from doing work that measurably improves the lives of tens or hundreds of thousands of people," end of quote, "but that in settings where the likelihood of a range of challenges is high," quote again, "our job must be to cost-effectively and responsibly mitigate these risks rather than turn away from opportunities that dramatically improve lives." In the end, flaws in one of Evidence Action's previously lauded programs have not diminished the organization's reputation, but enhanced it. If more charities follow Evidence Action's lead and more donors reward organizations that honestly report the findings of their assessments and then make the difficult decisions that those assessments require, more resources will flow to programs that actually work and more good will be done. 3. The Millennium Villages Project. In 2005, the United Nations Millennium Project, directed by Jeffrey Sachs, launched the Millennium Villages Project as a means of implementing its recommendations at a local scale in rural Africa. The project was intended to assist villages over 10 years and in 10 sub-Saharan African countries to reach the Millennium Development Goals, using a combination of interventions in agriculture, nutrition, education, health, and infrastructure. The underlying hypothesis was that such a combination would enable villagers to escape the circumstances that kept them trapped in poverty. The project attracted support from many high-profile individuals, including Madonna, Bono, Angelina Jolie, Brad Pitt, and George Soros. In the first edition of this book, I described it as having the potential to be a model for how we can assist people to work their way out of poverty, even in a country with poor government and corrupt institutions. As I noted at the time, it was then too early to tell whether the multi-sector development approach project would be effective. But initial results were promising. Now that the results are in, it is clear that the initial promise has not been fulfilled. The project did not enable the villagers to achieve the Millennium Development Goals. To see such an ambitious and well-meaning project fail is disappointing. Perhaps more disappointing, however, was the fact that the project was not more rigorously evaluated. As we saw with Evidence Action's No Lean Season, it is important to acknowledge mistakes and apply the lessons to future projects. Transparency and a rigorous approach to project planning and execution, as well as to evidence collection, is not easy and does not come cheaply, but it should be a priority in all new approaches to aid. 4. The Graduation Approach. A multifaceted program known as the Graduation Approach has been more rigorously evaluated and so far is showing good results in improving the situation of ultra-poor people. This approach has several elements: the provision of an asset, either cash to start a business or a productive asset, such as chickens, training in how to use the asset to generate an income, mentoring for the 3-year duration of the project, and access to a savings and loan facility or group. Randomized controlled trials were used to evaluate the program in 6 different countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. The trials showed sustained income increases in 5 of the 6 countries, as well as increases in consumption for those families who had been so poor that they were missing meals. Village Enterprise, a non-profit that was using the graduation approach in Kenya and Uganda, then invited the independent research organization Innovations for Poverty Action to conduct a large-scale randomized controlled trial of their 1-year version of the program. This trial again found sustained positive outcomes, including improvements in nutrition and subjective well-being. Altogether, at the time of writing, there have been 9 well-conducted randomized controlled trials of the graduation approach. Taken together, they provide strong evidence that the combination of providing cash or an in-kind asset, business training, and savings groups is important in improving the position of extremely poor people. A World Bank brief on the graduation approach suggests that it can be an integral component of strategies aimed at eradicating extreme poverty. Village Enterprise is, as its name suggests, an organization specializing in starting business enterprises in villages. Since 1987, it has helped start over 44,700 businesses and train more than 175,000 East Africans. The organization employs almost entirely local East African staff. It elected to undergo an independent impact audit by charity evaluator Impact Matters, which gave it a 5-star rating, the highest possible across all categories, and estimated a return of $1.80 of lifetime household income for every $1 spent. Village Enterprise estimates that its program costs about $595 per 3-person business, and that each new business improves the standard of living for approximately 20 individuals, based on the average family size in the region. If this is right, then lives are improved for an impressively modest $30 per person. Further research will show whether effectiveness can be sustained when these programs are conducted on a much larger scale. Using different types of evidence. The lesson to be drawn from the last section is that we can learn what works and what does not work. But to do so, we must use the most objective possible means of assessing programs. Ideally, that will mean randomized controlled trials announced before the trials are carried out, so that organizations cannot selectively release only favorable results, and with the results and methods completely open to public scrutiny. Then, when we have some evidence of what works on a small scale, we can try to scale it up while continuing to assess the intervention as it is applied on a large scale. Important contributions to our knowledge of how best to assess aid interventions have come from many different researchers, but 2 organizations stand out for their groundbreaking work in developing this field. The Jameel Poverty Action Lab, known in the poverty research field as JPAL, and founded at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology by Esther Duflo, was the pioneer in using randomized controlled trials to assess programs to assist people in poverty. It was followed by Innovations for Poverty Action, set up by Dean Carlin, who studied under Duflo and then became a professor of economics at Yale University. Both these organizations have been involved in assessing interventions mentioned in this book, such as microcredit programs and the graduation approach. JPAL and Innovations for Poverty Action research interventions, whereas GiveWell researches charities, so the 2 areas of research are not strictly separable. The strong evidence bases of many of GiveWell's and the Life You Can Save's recommended charities derive from rigorous studies by JPAL and Innovations for Poverty Action. Yet there is a lot more to be done, and so far, insufficient capacity to do it. In addition to supporting proven effective programs, as well as the organizations that identify and evaluate them, we need to be open to opportunities that we could be missing, interventions that have the potential to be even more effective than those we have now, but are assessed in different ways, or have yet to be adequately assessed, or may be difficult to assess. GiveWell has shown its awareness of this need by announcing plans to more than double its research staff, with the aim of evaluating interventions that are harder to measure, including opportunities to influence government policy. DREV, a non-profit design firm currently recommended by The Life You Can Save, collaborates closely with patients and healthcare providers to understand their most urgent needs. It then seeks to design and deliver innovative solutions. Using this approach, DREV has designed and developed a phototherapy device to treat neonatal jaundice and a prosthetic knee. Both meet the needs of people living in low-income countries and do so at much lower cost than equivalent commercial products. A smart continuous positive airway pressure device and a newborn nutrition enhancement tool are currently in development. DREV is on target for its medical solutions to treat 1 million patients by 2020. To track the impact of its work, DREV strives to measure not just the number of products they sell, but the number of people who use and benefit from the products. Providing mental health services in low-income countries is a neglected area of global health policy and could be another opportunity to do good at low cost. Mental illnesses such as depression are the cause of severe suffering that we tend to neglect because we do not see a physical disease or injury. In many affluent countries, treating mental illness is extremely cost-effective, improving well-being as well as increasing productivity, because mental illness is the cause of so much unemployment, absenteeism, and generally poor workplace performance. One study of 15 European countries estimated the economic cost of mental illness at 3 to 4% of gross national product. There is no reason to think that mental illness is less of a problem in low-income countries, where few people have access to any form of counselling or treatment. Since 2013, Strong Minds has sought to fill this gap by treating depression in African women. The organisation uses group therapy, a low-cost method that is adapted to the local culture because it is delivered by specially trained local women. Initial studies show that 75% of the participating women remain depression-free 6 months after treatment ends. Strong Minds is seeking to scale up this method to progress towards its vision that one day every African woman suffering from depression will be able to take part in therapy that will give her the best possible prospect of leading a healthy, productive, and satisfying life. The very specific circumstances of a project I visited in Pune, India, ruled out evaluation by means of randomized controlled trials. Oxfam Australia was assisting rag pickers, women who make their living by sifting through the town garbage dump to collect not just rags, but anything else that can be recycled. When we went to the dump to see them at work, the overpowering stench forced some of our group to retreat to the car, where they stayed with the windows closed for the entire visit. Yet the rag pickers made a remarkable contrast to the filth, for they somehow managed to keep their colourful saris clean and bright while they salvaged metal, glass, plastic, even old plastic bags. They were paid only 1 rupee, about 3 cents, for a kilogram, a bit over 2 pounds, of plastic. Bad as that sounds, it was an improvement on previous prices when the rag pickers, who were from the Dalit caste, formerly known as untouchables, had been isolated and held in contempt as the lowest of the low, exploited economically and sexually harassed by the dealers to whom they sold their gleanings. The project owed its existence to Laxme Narayan, a lecturer in adult education at a university in Pune. She had been running a literacy program for rag pickers, but realized that they needed more practical help before they could focus on learning to read and write. She sought and gained assistance from Oxfam to help the women organize themselves into the Registered Association of Rag Pickers, which enabled them to demand better prices and protected them from harassment. A big breakthrough came when the association persuaded the Pune Municipal Council to issue rag pickers' identity cards that would allow them entry to apartment buildings. Residents were asked to separate their recyclables, and as a result, many rag pickers were able to work in clean and safe conditions, collecting recyclables directly from homes. Others still worked in the dumps, but at least they benefited from some of the new protections. The association began taking on other tasks, like running a savings scheme and a microcredit facility. Interest earned on the pooled savings was used to provide scholarships and school texts for members' children. Previously, small children had worked alongside their mothers in the city dump, but I didn't see any on my visit. I was told that most of the rag pickers now realised that by going to school, their children might enjoy opportunities that they had not had themselves. Before I left Pune, I attended a meeting of the rag pickers, held in a room in the cramped but tidy district in which they lived. I couldn't understand anything that was said, but the atmosphere was one of wide and lively participation. After the meeting, Narayan told me that the women very much appreciated the support Oxfam had given them. But the project had achieved its goals, and the Registered Association of Rag Pickers was now self-supporting and did not need further support. Oxfam is an advocate for policy change, as well as doing direct aid projects. And these attempts to change policy also have unique contexts that preclude randomised controlled trials. Looking at two of Oxfam's successful advocacy efforts will enable us to see the judgments we need to make to decide if such efforts are worthwhile. Mozambique has a population of 30 million, 63% of whom live on less than $1.90 per day. Women are especially at risk of living in extreme poverty, and according to traditional law, if a woman's husband died, the couple's home and land belonged to his family. Divorced women had no claim to property, and like widows, were left penniless and were often reduced to begging, while fathers who left their families had no legal obligation to support their children. In the 1990s, women in Mozambique organized a coalition to end these injustices. Oxfam provided technical support and training in advocacy skills and helped organizations from different parts of the country to meet and work together. To help raise public awareness of the need for change, Oxfam also supported a media campaign involving not only television, radio, and newspapers, but also street theatre to reach Mozambicans who do not read and lack access to radio and television. The campaign won support in many sectors of society and government. In 2004, the National Parliament passed a new family law requiring men to support women who were pregnant with their child, and once the child was born, to pay child support. The new law also granted women rights over the couple's property after 1 year of living together in a customary marriage. In 2009, a law against domestic violence gave women additional rights. Passing more enlightened laws is one thing, but having them enforced in a conservative male-dominated culture is another. Oxfam continues to support Mozambican women's organizations that inform women about their new rights and educate local police about the importance of enforcing the new laws. It isn't possible to quantify the impact of Oxfam's work, but the project appears to have contributed to improving the lives of millions of women who had been denied basic rights that we take for granted. Another Oxfam policy initiative took place in Ghana. When oil and gas were discovered there, it was uncertain to what use the new revenue that would soon be flowing into the government's coffers would be put. Ghana is a democracy and has an active civil society, so Oxfam could support groups seeking transparency and public accountability for the oil revenues. Oxfam's partners began an Oil for Agriculture campaign, seeking a substantial share of oil revenue for Ghana's impoverished farmers. The campaign succeeded. In 2014, Ghana's budget allocated $116 million, or 15% of the government's oil revenues, to agriculture, with most of it directed at poverty-focused agriculture to benefit smallholder farmers. For example, oil revenue was used to build a dam that provides water for 75 families cultivating small plots of land in Ghana's arid northeast. Since then, Oxfam has continued to support Ghanaian organizations that keep a watch on how the money is spent. Oxfam's expenditure on this campaign, including staff time, was no more than $200,000, with further modest sums paid to the local monitoring organisations. Can we then say that spending $200,000 led to $116 million in benefits for the poorest Ghanaian farmers in just 1 year, with sums on the same scale continuing to flow for a number of years? That may be the case, but it is also possible that the government would have reached the same desirable outcome without Oxfam's involvement. Suppose, though, that we very conservatively estimate that Oxfam's interventions only made it 1% more likely that a significant slice of the oil revenue would go to help Ghanaians in extreme poverty. In that case, Oxfam's actions still had an expected value of 1% of $116 million, or $1.16 million, with similar cost-benefit ratios likely in future years. That's still a remarkable return on the investment. Even if most advocacy campaigns fail to produce the desired result, as the campaigns to end US cotton subsidies have, so far, failed, one win, as big as Oxfam's win in Ghana, will help to pay for many losses. There is much to learn about how best to help people in extreme poverty, but our knowledge is increasing all the time. And as long as we are open about our mistakes, our knowledge will continue to grow. In this chapter, we've seen that changes in government aid policies could make a big difference. Not subsidising wealthy producers who can then undercut small peasant farmers in low-income countries, not tying aid to purchasing products domestically and then exporting them on national carriers, and not using aid to advance national political agendas. When government aid is focused on helping people in extreme poverty, it can be effective, and if it is used to enhance productivity, it can lead to increased exports that offset the potential Dutch disease effect of large aid inflows. It can also be valuable for improving institutions, and putting conditions on aid is a legitimate way to do that. Aid can play an important role in helping a country to heal after an internal conflict. There are differences between government aid and individual aid. As individuals, we can choose where we donate, and in doing so, we can have a big impact in extending the work of effective organisations. What we have not resolved, however, is how much we ought to be giving, especially when we have obligations to our families and when we are living among people who, in general, give little or nothing. So now, with a firm grounding in human psychology and in the facts about aid, it is time to return to the ethical questions with which we began.